Today on the Breaking Ground podcast, we're doing something a little bit different. I've been invited by Dinesh Patel to come down to the Arup's office in Charlotte Street in London, and what an amazing building it is. Hello, Dinesh. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you, Steve. It's great having you here as well. I'm a great fan of yours because I've seen the podcasts, and I think you're doing a fantastic job.
Thank you.
The important message you're getting across to the geotechnical community is that we are a family, and you've invited lots of different people with different topics, and it's great to listen to the podcast and learn from the experience of many people that you've interviewed. So I'm a great fan of you.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot to me, that somebody with your position in the industry and experience would value the work that we're doing. And of course, it's not just myself, you know, it's the guests really that make the podcast. So thank you to all of those, and hopefully we'll continue to grow, and hopefully a few more visits like this in person. Be interested to see how it goes today. Very, very different experience after 3 years of doing it on Zoom, to see how it works in person. But it's really nice to come down here to Soho.
Well, that's interesting, because just before you came into this room, if you like, we were talking about something that's dear to my heart, which is running, and you are a runner as well. Maybe the next time we do a podcast is when we're running marathon.
I think that might make the recording a little tricky, but maybe we could go for a run and make some notes afterwards. That sounds fun. So this episode, really, we've been talking about doing this probably for the best part of a year. Obviously, you had your sabbatical in India, but the timing can really be better because you were awarded legendary status. What's the official award title at the GE Award? Lifetime Achievement Award.
So humbled and appreciative of engineering EMAP and the judges and because it was from the industry peers, it meant a lot to me to receive such an accolade, if you like. You know, I didn't know I knew so many people.
Yeah, there's a lot of us out there, isn't there? You kind of look at the numbers in terms of turnover of the geotechnical sector, and it doesn't look that big, but actually then you start to realise how many engineers there are out there. And I suppose a lot of the work from the UK is actually carried out overseas, you know, the construction work. We're a real knowledge centre here in the UK. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend the awards, but the feedback I've had from friends and colleagues in the industry was that it was really an amazing speech that you gave, and really the high point of the awards themselves, and lots of individuals were really touched by your story and your journey, and of course we're going to explore over the next hour or two the journey that you've taken, some of the projects that you've been involved with. But I know that there was a very personal message that you put across, which hopefully you could share with us now on the recording, because some people won't have had the opportunity to.
Sure. Thank you, Steve, for those very kind words. I suppose I was kind of initially, you know, after I overcome the shock of actually getting a call to say that I'd got the Lifetime Achievement Award, and it was the first one, of course, so that's even more, you know. Then the pressure started piling up. I'm thinking, what on earth have I let myself in? Especially when the judges said that actually I've got a 5-minute speech or a 3-minute to 5-minute speech to give, you know. It's like an Oscar speech.
Well, yeah, it's the only speech that really is offered to anybody at the awards.
You just
pick it up and wave, smile at the camera, and off you go. So I think it's actually really nice that that there is space for that. I'm sure that we'll continue.
I think it was a reflection of You know, I could have just simply been rather non-committal and say, look, I had a great career and I did these jobs and that job. But I think I probably have got the audience to go to sleep, if you like. So I kind of went on a personal journey of my own, you know, in regard to my journey through in this country before I'd even joined the profession. And it was very personal because when you try and reflect on something that's really personal and painful sometimes, you know, because of the journey that you might have been on, do you want to share it to 1,000 people plus? But I thought that actually it was important for me to share that message, because what I was trying to show is that I came from the 1960s. I came to this country in 1960, and my parents had come when I was about 5 years old, and my brother was only about 9 months old. And we came from a war-torn country in East Africa. The Mau Mau was there. There was lots of...
Is that Kenya?
From Uganda.
Uganda, okay.
So there was lots of Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda were going through a big upheaval. Uganda hadn't had its independence. Kenya hadn't had its independence. There was lots of murders and attacks. And my parents had seen that, and they were rather worried that actually they needed to get out of the country quickly.
Now, this is Idi Amin.
It was before Idi Amin.
Right, okay.
Before independence. And I think I'm not sure about the history of it, but I think the Mau Mau was a way of actually trying to get independence for each of those countries from the British, if you like.
And, okay.
But we came to this country almost penniless, you know, and because we just, you know, we had the opportunity at that time. The British were encouraging the Commonwealth countries to come over, but they were coming over to do menial jobs,
sure,
because that's what they you know, bus drivers and manual workers, etc. So my father came over with broken English, you know, and I didn't speak English at all, and so you can imagine a five-year-old, you know, coming to Cardiff, as it was, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why I went to Cardiff, other than the fact that my parents had an inquiry to work with the Hanson factory, if you like, you know, where they made the bricks.
Yeah.
And so my dad put his hand and said, right, okay, this is one way of actually getting out of the country. They're looking for people to run the kilns and the brick industry that was there. So he came out almost penniless.
What was his profession in Uganda?
He was a semi-skilled contractor. He was a plasterer by trade, but he was pretty general. You know, he could put buildings up, if you like. You know.
Yeah.
But his main profession was as a plasterer. You know, and that's a job that wasn't going here. It was completely different. So when we came over, it was the 60s. It was actually an era where there was quite a lot of racial tensions happening in the country. You know, there was lots of people saying, well, why do we want the people from from Jamaica and, you know, Africa and India and Kenya, etc., coming to the country. We could do the jobs ourselves. And it was a rough time because of the racial tensions. It was an era where we were difficult to set foot outside without being faced with skinheads and people just approaching you and trying to rob you of what you've got, if you like, you know.
Yeah.
And you were a minority in a sense. And the struggles we went through were huge, you know, in regard to the situation we were in. It wasn't that the people were bad. It's just that, you know, they didn't understand the minority people. So they were always put down, if you like, you know. And it was hard to get really good jobs.
Yeah,
it was hard.
I think that's pretty compassionate of you, because it must have been quite a scary situation to be faced with, particularly at a young age, but
yeah,
really any age. Things have I'd like to think moved on a bit since.
Oh, it's definitely moved on a lot, you know. But I suppose the story I was trying to get across to people is actually when I went through this journey, when you go through a career in engineering, having gone through a rough background, you are probably a bit stronger than most people. Mm-hmm. You're more determined. You break out of this cycle of trying to feel as if you're always inferior.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of effort to get out of that shell and prove yourself. Mm. And I'm always forward looking. I never look backwards. Okay.
Yeah.
Whatever's happened in the past has happened, but I need to look forwards. Otherwise you go mental, so to speak.
Yeah. So you're using that hatred as a fuel for developing your career.
That's a great way, an alternative way of doing that. That's right. And because I came from, I'm clearly not Caucasian, you know, Dinesh Patel, a very foreign name. I'm an Indian background, you know, born in Uganda. Passionate Welshman, because I grew up in Wales, you know. I don't know anything about cricket, but I love my rugby, you know. So I come from that background. And when I started my career first here, it was a struggle because you had to work two or three times harder than any Caucasian to prove yourself as an ethnic person, if you like, from that background. And I was trying to, the speech was personal because I wanted to show that you can overcome poverty. You can overcome prejudices. You can be an ethnic person and try and get to the ranks that I have got. I've been fortunate to get to become a director and an Arab fellow in my organization. You know, it's hard work, but don't let any of that be an issue in your development of a career. And I was appealing to probably the younger generation who are, you know, every time I go to these conferences, every time I go to Grand Enduring Awards, etc., you see maybe 30% of the audience being from outside the Western countries. They're Chinese, they're Africans, they're Indians, you know. And I was appealing to the younger people to say, you can get to the top, but you've got to have the determination and the will to do that. And we're living in an environment, in a country now, that is more tolerant than when I was being brought up, if you like.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it must have been so intimidating. I remember going to my first Federation of Pioneer Specialist Awards, and there was one woman, and I struggle to remember, but I think barely any ethnic minorities at all. So it must be so intimidating going into that sort of environment. Actually, things have moved on. So The GE Awards is a very multicultural, mixed gender event now. Really positive.
Yeah. No, I think in the last 10, 15 years, even 20 years, you know, it's become a completely different industry compared with the industry I was brought up in. I mean, when I was going through my A-levels, you know, I was the only Indian in the whole of my comprehensive school.
Right.
This is back in the 70s, if you like. And imagine, you know, what are you saying today? This is in Cardiff, you know. And the school was a very big comprehensive school, but I was the only Indian. When I joined Arabs, as it happens in geotechnics, there were only three people. I was the only Indian.
Yeah.
There was a Sri Lankan lady, the only lady, Lohini, and there was Asim Gaba, who was from Pakistan, you know, and we were the only three people, you know, back in 1980, if you like, you know, that you could see as being non-Caucasian, if you like.
Yeah. So
it was a different company compared with today, if you like, where there are probably 30-40% women. And an equal amount of people from the Asian continent as well.
So you started at a good point there with your school days. So I'm interested to know what your thought process was. Okay, you had a father that had been involved in the construction industry, but at the time, the construction industry in the UK was very, very wide. You know, it wasn't an industry that attracted the few minorities that were in the UK, you must have been quite strong-willed and convinced that that's where your future lied to make that decision.
Yes, I was always inquisitive. I loved maths. I loved physics. I enjoyed asking awkward questions. So I suppose it was an upbringing that my parents taught me. You know, they always said that actually there are no bad people in the world. You know, even though they went through these issues, early issues, there are just people who don't understand you because you haven't communicated.
Sure.
Your culture, or you haven't appreciated their culture. So what he was trying to basically say, there are no bad people, it's just that there's a miscommunication when things are not going right, and you have to make an extra effort to show people that you're not bad, or that you understand, you know, that there are cultural differences, but we should be all getting on as human beings, you know, for the betterment of society.
Yeah.
And when people begin to understand you, you build up lifelong friends and trust in them. You know? And when you break down those barriers, you know, it's really important. So I was brought up, you know, to question everything from my parents, be inquisitive, you know, to ask some questions about, you know, for example, you're a runner. So, well, there's a bit
yeah.
You know, you don't know.
Find a connection with somebody.
But there's a
yeah.
connection
yeah.
there. You know,
yeah,
I know how hard it is to be a runner.
Okay? Yeah.
I know how easy it is to run a 10K run, but actually the determination of finishing a marathon, you know, you go through this, the same journey that you do in life. The first half marathon is pleasure, maybe.
Okay? Yeah.
You enjoy it. You get the buzz of the crowd, etc. You know, you're learning something, you know, which you do at an early stage.
Yeah.
And then as you go through that journey, you know, the next 17 miles, you know, you get into breaking points, if you like, you know. It's really hard, you know, to break that pain barrier. And that's another journey in life that you do. You know, it's, you know, you learn initial years, but then there comes periods of difficulty. You have to overcome those difficulties. But when you finish that final line, when you cross that final 26.1 miles, you feel so good.
Yeah.
You feel everybody is working as a human being, if you like, you know?
Yeah.
And everybody is clapping you on the back and saying, well done for finishing, etc. Wouldn't it be great if humanity always did that?
Yeah, there's great camaraderie in running, that's for sure. And the point you make about connections, I think, is really important. I'd always try and find something personal about people that I work with and go out of my way to instigate a conversation with them. You know, you don't always have to be talking about work. I think find a common ground and then move the conversation onto
yes.
work. So you enrolled at Cardiff University?
I was in Cardiff. I did my first degree in Cardiff. It was a bit of a challenge because my parents, we didn't have much money, but my dad worked two jobs, you know, to finance me through university. Had a bit of a grant. So that's when I graduated. I joined Robert McAlpine, Sir Robert McAlpine, on the Crown Building. That was a fascinating project. You know, it was one of the biggest devolution parliament buildings that was being built at the time.
This is in Cardiff itself,
Cardiff
isn't it?
Itself, that's right. And I loved being a site engineer and managing aspects of the project. I only did it for about 9 months. And then I had a call from Arup, which had an office at the time. And the office was pretty young, probably about 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it already had a reputation in Cardiff for doing interesting stuff. And I joined the structural division of the Cardiff office and was there for about a year. Part of it was understanding, because at that time you used to do all your detailing. So how the detailing worked, you know.
Yeah.
So you did your rebar schedules and bar schedules, and you worked with the team and began to understand how to read a reinforcement drawing, you know.
But you can still smell the ink on you.
And
you
still
was it ammonia, like when you you had a film and then you had another piece of paper that you'd feed through this machine?
Absolutely. It was actually... today is, you know, you kind of think, really? But, you know.
I'm not sure anyone did a risk assessment on that. Hazardous to health in itself.
No. But it taught me one thing, you know, that we were brought up in the age of I did my A levels with logbooks. There was no calculator. The calculator just came on when I first started university, you know, and it was very cumbersome and big and expensive. I think it was a Sinclair calculator. And when I started at at Arabs, there were no computers. There were just, you know, you try to find solutions which were based on the science that you learned at university, if you like. You decided you had to boil the problem down to a simple situation, you know, and get to an approximate answer before you went off and did lots of design work and spent weeks, you know, doing lots of calculations, you know. You try to find what the answer might be, you know.
Well, there's an analogy there, isn't there, to what we're doing today in terms of you use some fairly straightforward software to come up with an answer and then use finite element software to prove it in a bit more detail, yeah. Maybe get some better graphical representation for the model of the soil behavior and the building behavior.
Yes, I mean, that's why I'm still passionate about the fact that, actually, go back to your first principal soil mechanics. Mm-hmm. You know, in my days, it was the first principal structural engineering. Go back to the first principal soil mechanics, you know, find out where you think you might be heading before you go off and actually do something really quite complicated using finite element methods, etc. So whenever I'm, you know, teaching and mentoring people, these clever tools are too clever. Unless you know what you're feeding into it in terms of parameters and how sensitive those parameters are, the output that it gets is wrong. Unless you understand the constitutive models, you know,
yeah,
where it's more Coulomb or, you know, the Jardine model or the brick model, unless you know what you're inputting, it's rubbish in, rubbish out.
Yeah.
And this is why case studies are so supportive, and calibration of these against the tools that you have. The simplest might be, you know, you measure data and you calibrate against Wallop or FRU. Mm-hmm. You know, those are simple tools you can run quickly. You don't have to spend, you know, waiting for the answer that might arrive from a very complicated model in 2 weeks' time or 3 weeks' time. You know, often you use those models really to understand movement on some very complex structures.
Yeah.
Tunnels or buildings which are impacted by a very deep excavation, for example. But your analytical tools, your simple calculations should inform the design of what's going to be built.
Yeah, I think stuff like the Young's modulus of soils, there seems such a huge range in possible values that you could adopt. Mm. and the way it influences the soil movements is really significant. So that sensitivity, yes, analysis part of the design is really crucial.
Yeah.
We're probably getting a bit ahead of ourselves in the program.
Jumped
there.
Around a little, yeah, bit, but actually, when I just complete that. So I started off in the Cardiff as a structural engineer, and then someone actually in geotechnics actually asked me to spend a bit of time doing a site investigation in a local investigation in Cardiff, and I suddenly got into other areas that I thought, this is great, you know, that I enjoy. One of them was actually, this was an archaeological site. So, you know, I suddenly began to understand archaeology and history. History was a passionate subject for me when, yeah, I was in school. You know, I loved history. You know, so that's kind of that and geology and being tied down by codes. In those days, there were very few codes on geotechnical solutions. It was based on case studies, empiricism, etc. Whereas, you know, when you're bounded by structural codes, you know, you have to follow BS 8110 as it was, or even before my time, it was CP114, you know.
Yeah.
It was kind of, you know, geotechnics gave me the ability to think outside the box and to think and read a lot of material that informed my later years and my journey in how I did things. And that, and I had the opportunity early on, which at the time I didn't appreciate, but I appreciate more now, to work in a top institution called BRE, Building Research Establishment. And I was there.
So had you been seconded from our BRE approach?
Yeah.
Yeah.
London Arabs were looking for someone to be parachuted into BRE to help them with a project which is called the Tethered Leg Platform Systems, which was looking at how foundations, pile foundations, played open and closed ended tubes, steel tubular piles, you know, grouted mini piles with CHS sections, how they worked in the North Sea, in the glacial tills out there, when they were hunting for oil in deeper waters, where you couldn't put a jacketed platform. So you created a floating a platform, if you like, that was tied down to piles. And so you can imagine that actually those piles are never seeing compression. They're always working in tension because of the wave action.
So, yeah.
And also they experienced some very significant cyclic loadings because of the way that the floating platform is actually moving horizontally and vertically. So they were looking, they had a very large, probably one of the largest research projects ever done to look at this. And at the same time, NGI were doing the same sort of type of work in the soft lays, you know. And this was in the heyday when we were getting oil out from the North Sea.
So who are NGI?
Norwegian Geotechnical Institution, okay. Another major big player, and still is.
So it was BP and BNOC, which was the British National
Oil Company. Yeah.
Which had never been absorbed by BP.
That's right. Yeah. So they sponsored me via Arabs to work at BRE, and I thought, oh, that's great, this is a research project. Mm-hmm. Be nice to do something on piles. And we had a test bed in Hornsey, basically, okay? And we had something like 12, 13 piles of different diameters, lengths, one-tenth scale piles, if you like.
Right. Yes.
In these ground conditions, in the glacial tills up at Hornsey. And we had a test frame, so we could actually pull the pile in tension and then do some cyclic loading horizontally as well as up and down with a tension load. And we tried to fail it to see how the amplitude of high cyclic loading, vertical loading, or horizontal loading created a post hole effect or not, and whether you got shaft degradation occurring because you've got something that's in tension and you do some cyclic up and down movements, if you like, does the shaft degrade because of the fatigue that occurs.
And these tests are actually being done out at sea, aren't they?
No, they were done on land.
Okay.
So we had a test frame that actually rolled down this track, and you can go to each of these piles and do a number of these kind of permutations in terms of testing. And we calibrated the piles in at BRE by putting instruments in there. We had sort of pressure devices, you know, so we can measure the effect of stresses in the ground as well. We had core pressure devices as well, you know, fitted in there. We had piezometers in the ground so we can see how the whole thing worked, you know. We drove these piles in initially to see what the excess core pressures were due to driving. And then when it got supposed to settle down, we could test the piles in these circumstances. And that was for almost 2 years.
Right.
So we
and did the performance degrade over time? Did all these cycles reduce the tensile capacity of the
piece? If the amplitude of the vertical cyclic load was almost as big as the static tension load, then you can see the pile literally shaking out of the ground. But if the amplitude of the cyclic load is small, a tiny proportion of the sustained tension load, okay, yeah, and the static tension load, then you wouldn't get the pullout. If the pile under the static tension load is also experiencing horizontal load, then you get a post-holing effect. So you get an unzipping occurring, you know, down the length of the pile. So the shaft friction gets reduced, if you like.
So you're almost getting like an annulus around the edge of the circumference of the pile. So literally not in.
Yes.
That's right.
Because it lets the post like a post, you know,
yeah.
You're pushing a post, you know, the head of the pile backwards and forwards. And
it didn't like remold or anything over time.
Not in the stiff clays that we're talking about, the sort of boulder clays. It probably is a different phenomena with soft clays because they're more likely to flow back in again. And, you know, so it was exciting times as a 24-year-old, you know, I was in this environment that actually was very scientific. And it was quite a strange environment because, first of all, I never knew two of my mentors very well, David Hinkle, you know, well-known geotechnical engineer, and Andrew Lord, who were checking my stuff, if you like, okay, via Arabs who were actually doing the checking of the BRE reports that we presented to Arabs, who were the intermediary between BP and BNR, you know, and the contractor, let's call him BRE.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It was a baptism of fire because I was there, as a young graduate, but what BRE really taught me was precision, you know.
Yeah.
Don't take shortcuts. Understand the science behind this. Then, once you're skilled enough and knowledgeable enough, then you can leap to an answer that you know is likely to be close to where you want to get to.
Yeah. So my question, really, on the back of that analysis and knowing that you are going to lose friction over time through those cycles, is how does that then inform the design of the permanent works? Or do you just bolt on another factor of safety to cope with that? Or what's the procedure within the design of those piles? How is it different from what you might expect in a conventional structure on land?
Mainly, conventional structures are always in compression, unless unless it's an electrical mast or something, you know. So you're not quite in the same environment. Yes, you get the tension load, but generally speaking, it's not as high as the compression load, you know.
But there's not like within, not as far as I'm aware, within the Eurocodes that says, right, if you've got cyclic loading, you need a factor safety of 5.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be that guidance out there.
That's right. I mean, we weren't necessarily telling people how to design a pile with factors of safety because they were already in codes, if you like. But what we were trying to do is do a research to show that actually how things behave, because most people didn't necessarily understand the impact of a high amplitude of cycling, say, you know, causing the pile to be pulled out of the ground gradually with time.
Yeah.
And the concern was that actually you need to make sure the piles were long enough to give you a sufficient capacity so that it wouldn't get pulled out from the high amplitudes of loads. So indirectly, you might say that actually that has a knock-on effect, you know, because you're building a pile longer than it should be.
Yeah.
In other words, maybe a higher factor of safety.
Sure.
But it was more to do with the fact that actually, if we didn't know that the amplitude loads was a key driver in actually pullout, then there would have been a lot of floating platforms would then suddenly disappear.
Like, I wonder whether there's relevance in tower crane art design that we're talking about. Constantly picking up loads from different points, you've got the wind force on it. Unless you're working next to a rail line, you don't really do anything different to the normal.
That's right. And I suppose in those kind of structures, all the things that you mentioned need to be considered. I mean, what is the potholing effect, if you like, if you've got wind loading as pushing a single plant backwards and forwards, you know? What is the pull-out forces, if you like? What is the amplitude, you know, that you're talking about? All of those things matter, especially if you are relying on a single pile as opposed to a group of piles within a cap of some sort, etc.
Yeah.
Where you get greater stiffness horizontally, and not all the piles are working at the same sustained tension loads, if you like, you know, because you've got a group of piles and you have a big thick cap
of
some sort. But certainly in regard to aerial towers, you know, you've got 3-4 legs and they've got individual piles, and we really do have to think about tension and cyclic loading.
Sure.
And it's very soil dependent.
Yeah. So at this point it's sort of mid-80s, you've moved to London, because I think BRE was Watford area, isn't it?
Yeah, so it was in Watford.
Yeah.
And in those, I just missed John Burland, because he just left to become professor at Imperial College. My boss was Hugh St. John at the time, and Andy Gallagher. And I got to know some very, very famous people that just at the time was just reading about, if you like, you know, Andrew Charles, Andrew Penman, Randolph. I just missed him as well, because he went, Mark Randolph.
He was famous for a lot of offshore work as well.
Offshore work, and that's right, a lot of the sort of planning type work. Yeah. But there was a huge amount of people there that I had a huge amount of respect for. And the strange thing was that, you know, in our industry at the moment, we're called geotechnical engineers or senior geotechnical. They were called scientists. Right. So you became a scientific officer. So suddenly I had to ditch my credentials as a geotechnical engineer and become the lowest of the lowest scientific officer, you know? And then you build up to a higher scientific officer and then a principal scientist, which was, I think, Hugh was at the time, you know? And then Hugh left about a year later to join, but actually...
And formed GCG,
of course. But it taught me, as I say, drill into the problem, understand first principle soil mechanics, and then once you've understood your first principle soil mechanics, then you can do things which are shortcuts, if you like, but that requires a skill and a knowledge that you bring to the time.
Yeah. So you move into the London office of Arents. What do they get you doing? What was your first job?
It was quite strange. When I first joined the London office, you know, I knew nobody, even though I'd been in London for almost 2 years, because I knew everybody at BRE.
Yes.
And my home base was BRE, okay? So the only people I knew was Andrew Lord and David Henkel. I didn't know what their reputations were, you know, until I joined the London office, you know?
Yeah.
And they were very, very, they were great engineers.
Was that Andrew Lord? Was he head of geotechnics?
Martin Stroud was head of geotechnics at the time that I joined. And Tim Moore was one of the founding fathers of geotechnics. And he was a fountain of knowledge on chalk.
Yeah, I remember he wrote the Syria guidance in the on chalk.
And he was also had quite a good connections with BRE as well.
Mm-hmm.
So when I first joined the London office, this is typical of Arabs, if you like, okay, yeah. They said, we're not going to teach you too much design, but what we're going to teach you is how things are built.
Yeah.
And you're going to be in RV. Okay. So I took a bit of, let's say, a desk study, and then some
that's, of the sorry, yeah, that's a resident engineer. It might not be a term that everyone's familiar with these days.
So I do a desk study, and then that leads obviously to some geotechnical investigation. Okay, and I said, oh, right, okay, why do we supervise the as a resident engineer the full time? And there'll be a project in Edinburgh, for example. So I worked in Edinburgh for 3 months, you know, supervising a geotechnical investigation there, and then there would be something in Bristol, so I went around, you know, various parts of the country. But also, it wasn't just geotechnical supervision; it was actually climate supervision as well.
Yeah.
So I'd see board piles, CFA piles, mini piles being installed, drill piles.
At the point, there wasn't a lot of instrumentation on piles, was there? Which I guess made
not
the role
CFA piles.
A lot more crucial.
Yeah.
But, it was quite commonplace, I believe, to have so a resident engineer effectively is a structure engineer that would sit on the projects on the client's behalf.
That's right. There used to be a clerk of works that protected the architect's interests, you know, finishes and things like that. You know, goodness gracious, the times I've seen that perfectly good column being broken down because it had a few blemishes that actually the architect would not have liked, you know. And structurally, it was all fine. It sent shivers to me now, you know, on sustainability, etc. But I learned a lot seeing things being built.
Yes.
As an RE, as an assistant RE generally, because of geotechnics, was working for a structural RE generally, you know, on certain building projects, you know. And, but it actually became very beneficial because when I started doing real design after about a year and a half later, you know, I began to understand backwards, maybe, you know, how things were being built.
Yeah.
And what I needed to watch out for. So I was probably a lot better designer than someone who'd actually just started doing several years of design work and having very little resident engineering experience. And that's why I'm still passionate today about actually things that are on site and seeing things being built and how designs should be buildable, etc. But to cut a very long story short, a couple of big projects I worked on. First one was an air rights building over Charing Cross Station called Embankment Place. So it was a structure that had a big arch at the top, 36 meter spans, column spans, and 12 meters in column grids, if you like, through the platform of Charing Cross Station. And there's this huge arch that was about 10, 15 stories above the platform, and floors were hung off the arch. Okay, so it's basically a set of 12 decks that formed the floors of the offices that were off this arch. And Charing Cross Station is a viaduct, and you could only build the foundations underneath the arches of the viaduct, and they were called handed piles. And they were about 35 meters deep, and they had the biggest bells that I ever did, and that has never been repeated since.
Well,
they were 6.5 meter diameters, bigger than my living room. Okay, you're swimming in space when you descend the handed caissons down to those levels.
So how long did it take?
Probably about 6 weeks to build.
But surely over that period, because you're not supporting the shaft with anything at this point.
Right? No, you are. Well, the way that we, the first challenge that we had at the time was actually how do we build the handed caisson through a water-bearing gravels that were up to 6 meters above the top of the plain? The arches themselves were founded on Victorian strip foundations, brick and concrete foundations, but we were locating our foundations in between the the arch piers, if you like, you know, to mitigate against movement on the arches, and these were independent structures. The first thing was, how do I construct the upper part of the Hander caisson without the ground collapsing or coming in, driven by a 6 meter head of water from the outside? So what we designed was actually some segmental rings, of course, the light tunnel rings that we still have. Charcon rings, they were called at the time. I'm not sure whether charcon rings are still around or not. But essentially, they were segmental rings that you created to form a 2.7-meter shaft. It had a cutting shoe. And the reason we had a cutting shoe was because we needed to push the caisson down to try and create the seal into the London Plate. Yeah. But there would be so much resistance that we created a cutting shoe with a slightly oversized external shoe, if you like. So you drew down the ground with an annulus behind it, if you okay. But you filled the annulus with bentonite so that actually the ground friction was reduced. So you ended up with a concrete collar at the top. You assembled your initial rings in there. You had jacks fitted to the concrete collar.
Did you jack to force it down, or did it just undermine the...
You had the jacks to allow you to push it down, but there was still too much friction on the inside of the caissons because there is no annulus. The annulus was really to stop the ground falling in by having a bentonite to do that.
Yeah.
So we had miners going down, okay, and they were digging away to address the imbalance of water pressure and hydraulic failure of the soil. We need to have a plug of soil above the cutting shoe so that the... you wouldn't get a sudden a boiling problem
of sure.
Silt and sand suddenly forcing its way and endangering the miners.
Yes.
So we designed it in such a way that we understood what that plug needed to be.
Yeah.
So they didn't go beyond that in terms of digging. Otherwise, we get soil inclusion, ground loss, if you like, coming into the hole, which is then having an impact on shed frustration.
Were you still having to dewater though, as
we were dewatering. But we were always pushing in a length of casing and cutting shoe ahead of the plug. When you got into and jacking, of course, when we got into the clay, we can take away the cutting shoe and then we can dig a meter depth, which is the depth of the ring.
Yeah.
And that's obviously unsupported, but is it clay? And then you put the rings in place and you grab the outside of the rings through holes that are within the segment, the concrete segments that a prefab that we bring in. And you grout the segment, and that's all in a 12-hour operation. And then you keep doing that until you get down to about 35 meters, and then you put a bell at the bottom.
Oh, so even once you're in the clay, so you've done that exercise, take the case on down into the clay.
Yeah.
You're still supporting it.
Yeah.
Just because the clay presumably would soften too much.
Yes. That's right. The clay would just collapse if you try. And there was no way that you could actually leave a hole for 6 weeks, you know, without a support. So it's probably a safer method than if you try to keep a hole open over 12 hours. And in the sense that actually every increment of 1 meter increments has got a liner, which is grouted back into the clay. So the effect of softening is significantly reduced and controlled. And the bit where when the bell was biggest is actually is the challenge, if you like, you know, because you then have to put a timber lagging around the shelf of a 60-degree slope, if you like, that is forming the bell, you know. Mm-hmm. Especially when it's actually 6.5 meters, you know, diameter, because that means that actually the height of the bell is probably near the to get you that kind of shape that you want.
Do you think that would be built now, given sort of modern construction
I think
standards and concerns around safety?
I think handed caisson passé, we have done it, Claridge's, okay, clearly using a similar type of technology. Yes, the answer is it, you can do it, but only under special circumstances. The HSE will challenge, the work that you do when it comes to under caissons. But we have shown from what we've done in the past with under caissons and what we've done at Claridge's, for instance. Yeah. I know we're jumping 40 years ahead.
Yeah, we'll definitely cover Claridge's in this podcast. If listeners are worried that we might miss out, we certainly won't. We might have to split this recording into two episodes, but it'll come up at some point.
the health and safety wasn't as tough as it was 40 years ago today, so things like embankment placement more easily than now. I wouldn't necessarily go and do another 6.5 meter bell because the challenges involved are enormous. You're almost building a little cathedral at the bottom, if you like, in terms of a bell of that size. But and the maximum I've done with handed caisson, which are still safe, is about 4.5 meters diameter. Okay, and we'll explain that later. But at the time that we were doing this, we didn't have a solution to support an air rights building 36 meter span. The lows we were talking about were half the weight of the Eiffel Tower, so 40 megaliters, if you like. And the only way you can support those lows was using 6.5 meter bells.
Yeah.
Okay.
And when you were pouring the concrete, you must have been pouring it over
a day,
several days.
It would be a bit, I can't remember what the volume of the concrete was now, but it was certainly.
But the stuff at the bottom is going to be hard by the time you get this stuff at the top end.
A long time.
Was there any special sort of precautions you had to take around the pool?
I don't recall, but I remember playing thermocouples into the. And surprise how the temperatures reached about 45 degrees or something in concrete during the curing process. And I remember the jury was out in regard to how you were designing piles. You had a certain people like Tom Winterbrook that said, look, you can't use the whole length of the shaft above the bell, for instance, in design.
Yeah.
And I remember once writing to Tomlinson and said, look, you say ignore 2 times the diameter of the bell as the length above the roof. Well, in my case, I've been losing 13 meters of shaft, on a 6.5 meter bell. Well, I can't afford to do that. So I wrote to Tomlinson and said, in your book that you says this, you need to provide evidence as to why I should be losing twice the diameter of the bell as the shaft above it. And he said, actually, because I haven't got the evidence, but I just thought that it'd be quite nice to put it into the book to give you a red flag. So you have to think about how much movement you're likely to get on an unveiled pile compared with a straight shafted pile under working load conditions.
So Tomlinson's quite almost a mythical figure because his design, pile design and construction practice been around lots of editions for 30, 40 years.
Yes.
Or more. I'm not sure. Is he still alive?
No. He's lived to a very long age, I think 90-ish or something. He passed away when I was in my 30s,
But the book's still out there.
The book is definitely
one
of those books that actually young Virginia is definitely read because it's a mine of information, empiricism, theory, etc. And good practice.
So somebody's out there updating it each year.
Correct. And I think it's one of those books which is clearly something I grew up with and revered, as not the Holy Bible, but actually certainly something that was on my top of the reference books that I wanted to read. I was amazed when I was a kind of, I don't know, 20, 28-year-old, you know, maybe 30-year-old, you know, talking to someone who's actually had retired and was probably around about 60 years old or 70 years old, you know. And he wrote back to me very nicely in his handwritten scrawl. There was no typewriters in those days, okay, no computers, etc. He wrote back in a hand letter, saying, Dinesh, thank you for asking these questions. I have no evidence. I thought it'd be useful advice to do. The only reason I made that recommendation is because if you push the pile, the underlying pile too much compared with, you know, 1% of the pile diameter and the workload condition, you might open up a wedge of soil, which is above the belt, yeah, you know, and that might open up a gap, if you like, you know. So I thought the gap might be twice the diameter of the pile. Once I understood that, I had to go to David Henkel and say, David, you know, this is not fact, if you like, this is, you know, and we sat down and we collectively decided that actually that we were not going to take that advice and take the whole length of the pile in order for us to get to the numbers that we got. And then we instrumented a pile. So BRE, Gerwin Price, mm-hmm, bless him, who I knew, and John Berlin did a lot of work with him on the Lisa Pillion Terrapisa. He came and instrumented a pile, a live pile, after we built the project, okay? And I've been monitoring that for the last 25 years to see what the load distribution is in the hand of case on, and how much load is going to the bell and how much load is going to the shaft, you know, and what the change in water pressure is doing. Because, you know, water pressures are rising in the ground.
Yeah.
And so you can actually see how the load on the base of these bells are changing from a total stress to an effective stress scenario with the rise in water pressures that occur in the lower aquifers. Huh. And that's quite fascinating because, clearly the under drainage has reduced the hydrostatic pressures in the clay to sub-hydrostatic pressures. Typically, it might be 50%, you know, and the industrial age of pumping lots of water has disappeared. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing that the sub-hydrostatic piezometric pressures rising back up to about 70%, yeah, to 100%. Percent, or getting to it, if you like, you know, still about 70%. And we can see from the load cells that we put into our underlying piles, the effect of a reduced effective stress causing the piles to move more and load up more. Fascinating.
Because anything we should be concerned about, or
no,
are we talking?
No, it supported the original design that we did.
Yeah.
Okay. It supported the conclusion that the alpha is not 0.3 on these shafts of underlying piles. It is about 0.5. Okay. So there is no large scale softening effects that actually occurred. So it's quite nice to go back, which is quite to have long term history data like that.
Yeah. We'll talk about alpha values in a moment. But you went down these piles and specimens. It must have been pretty scary going down there. I know you.
It was actually, I suppose I was this naive chap. Oh, by now, I had already had experience as a resident engineer,
yeah,
on the City of London School project, which had 350, 320 underlying tiles, and I descended every single one of them all the way down to the bottom to inspect the bases after they were cleaned out by the contractor.
Yeah.
And
that was a requirement of sort of building control, was it?
That was a requirement of building control. Some of the building control people used to go down as well, you know, yeah. But it was a control. Building control in those days were extremely powerful. Mm-hmm. And they still are, but
yeah,
they were even more powerful in those days, you know. And they had roving people that took a genuine interest in making sure that the foundations were built in accordance with, yeah, you know, design. And they were the checkers, so to speak.
Yeah. But you get lowered down in a cage by a crane.
Well, it's interesting. Yes, definitely I went down a cage, and the cage was probably about 2 meters.
Yeah.
Okay. It was later, much later on, that it was deemed a bit unsafe. Because
you had a nasty experience.
Sorry? Yes.
With a potential collapse.
Potential collapse. That was much later, and that was at Moore London back in the 1990s, you know. But up until then, it was that industry, well, very much industry standard to send the parts to inspect them if you were an engineer designer. Solution, if you like. But the incident that worried me was it was getting tougher and tougher up until sort of 1999, etc. And there was a lot, the health and safety was becoming a lot more stringent, etc. And I think that was probably the last time I descended a pile that was not hand dug, so to speak, you know.
Yeah.
A descendant pile with underreams. And the incident that really brought it to mind about safety was actually a collapse that we occurred. There was a building we did all 7 buildings in Moore London, which is near Tooley Street, you know, which is a lovely place now to visit. But we had some underream piles there. And I remember standing in front of a rig that was building this underring pub. So one of the big ones, about 4.5 meters in diameter. And the augers were going down. They built it all the way down to the toe level. Then they started to underream out with the underreaming tool. And they were halfway through this 4.5 meter bell. And the ground opened up behind the casing. And it was actually on the... It wasn't on the side where the driller was, where his rig was, and it wasn't on the side that I was facing the rig, watching this from a distance of about 10 meters. But I saw this ground suddenly collapse in, and the River Thames gravel just swept into the shaft of this hole. There were no signs, obvious signs, because I was watching the material coming out. It was nice and dry. You know, the first thing that you do with these things is a clay arising dry. Yeah. It's water, you suddenly stop and say, look, stop, guys.
Yeah.
You've got to be very watchful. Something's not quite right. The seal on the casing is gone. Or, you know, where is this water coming from? Is it groundwater from a clay stone or a sand lay you've hit in the clay? Nice and dry until this incident, just without notice, it just came in. And the reason that it came in, it was because the casing was penetrated about a meter into the clay. Okay. And there was a clay stone. And unbeknown to anybody, and we found out later it was a clay stone, unbeknown to anything, the action of the auger going up and down and, you know, the material coming out of the process of drilling the bells, had started to slowly disturb the clay stone that was sticking out of the shaft, if you will. Okay. And when the clay stone suddenly went, the wedge of clay behind it, which is only about a meter and a half or so above it, came in. So this wedge of clay came into the shaft below the casing, and the water-bearing gravel was just swept in from the Thames gravel, straight into, filled the whole of the shaft up to the top of the casing. You know?
Yeah.
And that was the light bulb moment where I said, I'm not having any of my staff going down the underring. And I remember one of the young starters was Sarah Glover, who's now an associate director, and, you know, she did most of these jobs, and she went down these underings. And she was the only female at the time doing this underreaming piles under my tutelage, you know. And I just said to her, look, you know, you can't, we're not doing it. And I sat down with the MD of Expanded Pioneer at the time, that was Peter Webb, before Expanded got bought out. And I said, there's got to be a better way of doing it. How are we going to do it? Well, actually, there was a penetrometer that Bashy had. Okay, where you didn't have to send a camera down, you get a penetrometer, but you had to buy that. You know, it's very difficult to go out and buy something or hire it, if you like, you know. So Peter said, well, look, what do you think we should do? And I said, look, you know, when I was actually much younger, we were automatically on the end of a Kelly bar had a U4 tube, which you inserted into the ground when you were, you know, so we take a sample and do some tests on it. Why don't we do that by having some jacks that push the U4 tube into the ground on a dummy underlying tool, if you like, okay, on the arms of it. We can get a sample of the shelf and make sure we didn't have an aerobar type clay matrix that was caused by disturbance, because if you have something that's like aerobar, when it squeezes, you've just lost your main bearing. So we wanted a solid piece of clay that they could cut, if you like.
Yeah.
So we could trial this by this thing. And then we said, look, you know, we'll get some CCTV cameras which actually have the right flooding. So we created a dummy bell. So once you finished it, the bell, you dropped in a dummy bell with all these contraptions in it, and you can take an image of the whole thing and take samples. We had an extruder on site, and you can see what sample you were getting. And if you were happy with that, then you completed the pile. Okay. And Peter Webb at that time was very inventive in the sense that they had their own yard in Grimsby. Together, we came up with this device, you know, which a lot of the industry members then followed, if you like. And,
yeah.
Which is great, you know.
Yeah, they're still very inventive. And fun enough, I've got a meeting this afternoon with Spandex.
Ah, fantastic. MD, John Chick.
Yeah, John Chick. about advancing some of the. So you mentioned there about the LDSA and building control. You worked closely with the LDSA, and of course, you're very famous for your paper talking about alpha values and U38 and U100 results, which is really where I came to know you. And I do remember as a young engineer actually coming to Arup's office, occasionally these sort of evening soiree type events.
Oh, yes.
And I met you, and I was obviously it was a paper that I used a lot, so it was a real honour to meet you, and you were very very kind to me at the time. Somebody I'd mentioned your name, and somebody introduced me, so thank you for that. Made me feel very welcome.
Well, I'm honoured today to meet you.
But yeah, I'd be interested to hear a little bit more about that paper, and maybe it's not quite as well known by the younger engineers now, because probably some of the parameters that are being adopted are more well established, and there's not really any U38 samples being used by ground investigation companies anymore. But could you explain a little bit more about that paper for our listeners?
Yes. It came about because of my master's at Imperial College. I went back to do a master's at solar mechanics, you know, and by now I'd probably had, you know, 8 years of a design on various projects, quite complex projects with piling in London, really, you know. And every time that we faced the LDSA, we were challenged on certain parameters we use, certain factors of safety we used, the methodology for ground investigations was different, you know. There were a number of people who were doing site investigations, and they were taking U100 samples, but then they were taking three lots of 38mm samples within the U4 tube when it was in the laboratory. So, you know, they instead of testing the whole tube of U100, which is 100mm in diameter and maybe 200mm in height, if you like, you know, they were taking 38mm samples, you know, through the same sampler, you know, and which is 76mm in height. And have three of them, one at the top, one in the middle of the tube, and one at the bottom, if you like. Okay.
What was the sense in that? Why did you?
It was historical. It was done something that actually is a legacy of Skempton back in 1959, if you like.
Yeah.
Okay? And it was just that in those days, they literally didn't even do U100. It was like 38 mil samples that they used to get as well from his investigation. So it was historical. And there was some seminar work that was done at BRE by Whittaker and Cook, who showed that actually the smaller samples, like the 38 mil samples, are measuring the intact strength of the clay, not the fissured strength of the clay. You know, clay is fissured. The strength of the clay is lower when you capture fissures.
Mm.
So they were advocating the fact that actually you will overestimate the undrained shear strength of the ground, the London clay, if you didn't consistently get fissures. So the fissures of London clay can be easily missed with smaller depth sizes of sample. So you have something which is 76 mil height and 38 mil. The fissure might be 200% or 150%. So the chances of getting the fissured strength of the clay was more prominent for 100 mil samples, because your testing sample was 200 mil height. And they showed that actually, if you back analyze the results of test piles against these larger samples, you got better correlations in terms of the alpha values, in terms of the end bearing that you're getting. If you just use an average line or a mean line for the data, whereas when you did 38 mil samples, if you go historically back to what Skempton was saying, he was saying you can take an average line for the undrained shear strength for a 38 mil sample, but you use a lower alpha value, you use a value of 0.45, for example, you know? You can't use the mean line to work out the end bearing. You had to use omega factors, which are factors that reduce that average value to a lower value, basically to the lower of the scatter of the data, if you like. Okay, yeah. So all the omega values are doing is a multiplier, like a 0.75 on top of your normal end bearing calculations. But effectively, it's lowering it to lower than the mean. And the reason for that is because pile tests were showing disagreements unless you did that when it came to designing green piles, etc.
Yeah, I suppose if you're really reliant on the end bearing, and it's, you know, it's a big proportion of your capacity, and it's actually at the lower end of the strength range, then it's going to have a huge effect on the overall capacity. And actually, we do something similar with designs in chalk. We very much take the lower bounds line,
yeah.
Where it's more for shaft friction piles in clay. It's kind of a medium.
That's right. So you know, the site investigation at the time was doing loads of 38 mil samples, and then Arabs, bless them, before even I actually got involved in 65 or something, and John Berlin was there as well, you know, worked for us for a couple of years in 63 or so. So there was an interest, we heard about all this lovely work that BRE were doing, and we just changed the way that we're designing our site investigations to say the larger the sample we can get out of the ground and test that in the laboratory as tracks or samples, the better we will get the results. So, and then we started saying, you know, just typical of Arabs, isn't it? You know, we'll do something different to the rest of the world, if you like. Yeah. You know? we'll just do it the way that actually, this is a scientific way, it's showing it. So we had a load of test data that actually was based on 100 mil samples, okay? Now, you can imagine this, your young, naive person talk to the LDS and say, well, actually, we've got a load of case studies that actually relate to a site investigation that you do, which is based on 100 mil samples, not 38 mil samples. Therefore, I want to use an alpha of 0.6 as opposed to 0.45, you know? The look of horror on everybody's faces, if you like, you know? Well, where did you get this, you know? And I'm saying, because we changed the way that we actually take samples from the ground and test them, and by the way, you know, we'll also change some of the factors of safety as well, you know, so apply to the design based on contract pile tests and working trillion pile tests or no testing, okay. So that often led us to a little bit of friction between LDSA And when I decided that I wanted to go to Imperial College, I said to John Berman, who was my tutor, I want to do some research work on Arabs database. We got about 40, 50 PAL tests, go stretching back from when I did my dissertation in 89 all the way down to 1965. Okay. It has got every SI was supervised by Arabs. Every SI had sufficient number of lab testing. Okay. Yeah. Right. Every PAL test was supervised by Arabs. So there was a consistency, if you like, you know,
that not if we at all, that is not great.
Yeah, if you got variability, at least it's not variability because, you know, things have been because of lab testing or the method of testing, etc. You know, and I pulled all that together, and that led to some design rules for total stress design, and some design rules for how you would do effective stress design as well, you know, which was in the paper. But it also showed you that actually, instead of having something very complicated in terms of working out the settlement of the pile at working load and beyond, you can use the results of normalized results of the load settlement plots that we're getting from the pile tests, you know, to normalize the data so that you can actually use it on any project. And within a few minutes, you can say that actually at service stability load, this is the movement you're likely to get. Right? So for example, you know, typically, if you're looking at a working load, let's say in old speak rather than in EC7 speak, you know, a serviceability working load, then for a straight shafted pile, generally speaking, you should not get more than about 0.5% of the pile diameter of the settlement. So if you say 1.2 meters down the piles, you should not get at working load, serviceability, you should get 6 meters movement. At 1.5 times working load, it might be 10 something, okay? So those kind of rules of thumbs are also based on some slenderness ratio. Is it a big, you know, it's a short, fat pile?
Yeah.
Or is it a long, slender pile, you know? So there are graphs in the paper that shows you how the slenderness ratio of the pile can be a factor when you actually work out these movements, if you
okay?
Yeah.
And of course, nowadays, at 1.5 times the working life might not actually be far off from the ultimate capacity with
yes,
and tests and or a SLS type design method.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, sometimes you do, you know, if you you're talking about Eurocode there, I think, yeah. You know, the fact that actually the design methods are different because, you know, there are typically when you do design a pile, you should get, if you got something like 70% dead load and 30% live load, effectively, the partial factors that you're applying to the shaft frictions, shaft resistances, and the base resistances, if you like, you know, should you reveal a pile of a similar length to the working stress design, the LDSA was, sure. Okay, yeah, and the reason why the UK annex has got those partial facts. It's been developed effectively to try and get compatibility to the working stress methods or the LDSA notes. Okay.
Yeah.
As an example, for example, if you were talking about piles in London play, you know, that I am rather than somewhere else, if you like, you know, and if it's rotary and CFA piles, obviously there are different rules for driven piles, etc., possibly. But the important thing is actually that when you are testing piles, it's an understanding of the basis on which the piles have been derived in terms of the back analysis. You know, there's nothing in the UX annex, the UK annex that says alpha should be 0.5. It doesn't say what the limiting alpha CU should be if you've got, you know, very, very long piles and stiff piles. You know. It doesn't necessarily say that maybe, you know, if you've got short, stubby piles, lower loaded on any main bearing, that you might be designed for a shaft control pile, you know, to limit movements, you know. That's another rule. maybe QSU over 1.2 to control shaft, if you like. So there are things that actually in EC7, which is not being said, but is actually in the LDSA. The LDSA still tells you something about how you build the pile to get you your design values that you're looking for, if you like. EC7 doesn't do that, you know. So, but there is a prescriptive method in EC7 that says, you know, if you've got loads of data, if you've got loads of information about how you build these piles successfully and pass them, there's no reason why you shouldn't be also designing for a different way, if you like. Okay? Yeah. But essentially, whatever you do, you know, there's a compatibility between the pile lengths that you get from EC7 and the working stress method that I've been talking about, which is the LDSA. But the LDSA came about following the MSc dissertation. It came about because after I did my dissertation, they wanted a guidance design for piling. And that's what we did. But at the time, we reflected on the fact that the industry that has historically built up piling was still doing CRPs, still doing 38 mil samples. And, you know, to move the industry forward, you really wanted to change that to maintain load tests and to change it to larger samples if you wanted. Yeah. So the paper was really trying to say that actually, if you do either one of those, you should end up with the same result, but you've got to do it in a very methodical way. You can't just pluck numbers. You've got to be understanding the data and how you go about doing it.
Okay.
And so that's how it became the sort of main guidance.
Yeah. Well, I think that's kind of brought us up to the millennium, so it's probably a good place for us to stop and pause and grab a coffee.
That's
and
great. Yes.
we'll split this conversation up so listeners can tune in to the next episode to hear about what you've been up to this century.
That's great. Yes, let's have a cup of coffee.